Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. Got a good one for you today. Cade Crockford's going to be here to talk to us a little bit about the Boston Marathon bombings and some new developments in that case and some older ones. See what she has to say. Cade Crockford, she's from the Massachusetts ACLU. Also, Jason Ditz from antiwar.com. It's not 100%, but it's very likely. I hope. Crossing my fingers. Cross yours, too, if you believe in superstitions. We're going to try to get Jason on for 1 o'clock Eastern time today to talk about what's going on in Israel. And, I know. I plead guilty. I really should have a longer list of Palestinian guests that I can call on. But really, Jason's been writing all this stuff up so well over the last couple of weeks. I know he's written at least one thing on all the different things I want to ask him about. There's, you know, new laws, plural, being introduced over there in Israel. The government's falling apart. Netanyahu's called for new elections. We've got to talk about that. And Jason Ditz, he's good on all this stuff and mostly easy to get a hold of, so there you go. But, you know, as long as I'm talking about Israel-Palestine, go read Ramsey Baroud today. You know, the wife loves all that Hunger Games stuff. I never read it. I guess I watched part of the first movie on the Pirate Bay version. Whatever. If you like it, great. But even if you don't like it, even if it's not your thing, because I don't really know what he's talking about when he makes all the comparisons to the movie, I still would like you to take a look at Ramsey Baroud's article today on antiwar.com because, the first part is about real life, the whole first part. And then he says, you know, God, it sounds so crass and lame to equate the suffering of the Palestinians to a Hollywood movie. But damn it, this is really good for making the point. Let me explain. You know how in the Hunger Games this? Well, that's how it is in the Gaza Strip. And that kind of thing. I think it's worth your time, especially if you like the movie. But even if you don't, even if you're not all that interested in the movie, it still, I think, will gain some perspective on the Israel-Palestine situation there. Ramsey Baroud at antiwar.com today. And then also we're going to have Chris Woods on the show. He's got a new one out about civilian casualties in the war against the Islamic State. And then, of course, he wrote the book on the drone war. No, really, wrote the book on the drone war in Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia. Especially Pakistan, I guess. Anyway, you remember Chris Woods, right? He used to be with the Bureau for Investigative Journalism and did such great work there. And anyway, so he's going to be on the show. He's got a new one, as I think I mentioned, in Foreign Policy Today. They'll let you look at a few articles per month for free. You know, they put up a big paywall looking thing, but if you look closely, you can read a few articles before they paywall you out of there. And I'm kind of torn because Foreign Policy, they've got some great writers, they cover some great news in depth, and I miss having that site readily accessible and having some of those articles go as viral as they used to go. Before they sabotage themselves by putting up this massive paywall the way they did. On the other hand, it's mostly all a bunch of pro-government propaganda and pro-government, pro-intervention understandings being laundered through there. So, you know, it's kind of the Washington Post version of foreign policy in the world. I mean, not in the very worst Charles Cruthammer way all the time, but a lot of that. So maybe it's better that they've gone and locked themselves in the basement over there at Foreign Policy. But occasionally they, you know, Stephen Walt has a blog there. They published Gareth Porter's great piece on the old Ayatollah and the new over in Iran, banning any weapons of mass destruction by religious edict. And now they got Chris Woods here writing some good stuff. Anyway. foreignpolicy.com for that today. And you know what? Time is short. I got so many guests. I got very little time to talk about the things I want to talk about. So here's one thing I want to talk about real quick. This is especially for liberals, lefties, progressives, conservatives, right-wingers of any kind, all you non-libertarians out there, and I guess you libertarians too if you don't know of it, although I think probably most libertarians might just roll their eyes and go, yeah, yeah, Scott, we know. But this isn't for you. This is for people who they think, you know, I like this Horton guy on his anti-war stuff, but boy, do I hate him on this and that, because boy, those libertarians, and you shake your fists. Well, you don't have to change your mind. I would just like to suggest to you one good article you could read that might help clarify your understanding of libertarianism. You can choose to agree with it or not, as you will. But I'd still like to recommend you the article, whether you're going to agree with it or not. If you'd like to read it, it's called Left and Right, The Prospects for Liberty by Murray N. Rothbard. And it's from 1968 when he was in his... I guess more left-leaning phase, but it's all right. It's plumb-line libertarianism. I guess maybe it's slanted a little bit more toward appealing to the left. But any conservative out there who actually wants to be consistent in any of your beliefs, if you do believe, you know, in any way in conserving old liberalism, conserving anything like the vestiges of an open market, and an open society here, there's a lot for you to like in there as well. It's called Left and Right, The Prospects for Liberty. And I got in kind of a ridiculous Twitter argument this morning with socialists who were saying, yeah, the killer cops everywhere and all this, what we need is socialism. Huh? More cops? More control? And that's going to set us free? Ah, liberals. And I know how liberals are. It makes perfect sense to me that you think that rich, white, business-owning, Republican, capitalist types, they're clearly your enemy. And that's true. Conservatives are your enemy. They want to use the state to beat you over the head, to initiate force against you, to take over your life and your property and make you do what they want. Well, being the mere image of that isn't really being its opposite, you see. The opposite of that is real liberty. And that's the point in Murray Rothbard's article. And I love it. It's such a great article. It's, you know, 3,000 words or something, and enough said. And I know for a fact, too, from my own experience, that having shown that article to liberals and conservatives, lefties and righties and progressives and pseudo kind of sort of political types, but not that vested interest in it kind of anyway, people and all different people have said to me, wow, man, mind blown, whole new understanding of the world I live in now. All right. Not necessarily they agree with everything in there. Not necessarily they're libertarian now. They might say, well, I still think we have to have a welfare state, or I still think we have to have a warfare state, or I still think this, that, or the other thing. But at least you have a much better understanding of what libertarianism is about. And I think that, you know, if you ask me, and I'm asking me, what's the one article to set people straight on what libertarianism is? This person tweeted to me today, libertarianism is nihilism. Actually, you're really just wrong about that. You really are. Libertarianism is based on, in huge part, the theory of natural rights and the inherent dignity of all men and all women. So you see right there, that's not nihilism. It's liberalism before liberals bought into conservative means, socialism, the power of the state to achieve their ends. That's what it is. It's class, libertarianism is classical liberalism perfected. That's what it is. The, you know, Anthony Gregory and them working out all the kinks. All right. Left and Right, The Prospects for Liberty. Felt like mentioning that. Also, of course, I'm always a day or two behind. And it was told to me, it was mentioned, hey, Cyber Monday, Donation Tuesday. On Tuesday, Scott Horton, you got to ask for donations. Oh, yeah. Well, I started to, but instead I just said, hey, you know what you ought to do is you ought to advertise on the show. You got a business. You got a group. Advertised on the show. I could also mention, hey, you could donate too. Help support the Scott Horton Show. Keep it going strong for another year. ScottHorton.org/donate. Anybody donates $100 or more, I'll send you a 1 ounce silver commodity disc from commoditydiscs.com. All right, right back with war news in just a sec. Hey, all Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver commodity discs. The first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. All right, so time is short, and I am going to have to talk Iraq War stuff with Jason if I do indeed get him from 1 to 1:30 Eastern today. But I got to have my say here, too, but I got to make it short and quick because I got to talk about the cops. There's so much cops news that I got to cover, things I want to say about it. So let me just say real quick, Ron Paul in 2002, in October of 2002, on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, introduced a declaration of war against Iraq. And then he, and this was all on YouTube, I'm sure it's on C-SPAN, they keep all their archives online. I'm sure you could find it on C-SPAN, maybe I should have during the break there. Anyway, he gave a little talk to the fellow members of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, and he said, I'm going to vote against this, and I don't want you to vote for it. You know, ultimately. But I do want you to vote for it if you're going to vote for an authorization for war against Iraq, for George W. Bush to decide whether to launch a war against Iraq, then no, I would rather have you vote for this instead. He was calling them out. It's your responsibility to declare war. You don't get to weasel out of it by saying, oh, well, all I did was authorize George Bush to decide whether to have a war or not. It's his responsibility, which is, of course, what Hillary Clinton and so many other congressmen of both parties tried to do, to weasel out of their responsibility for authorizing the Iraq war back then. Okay? But what Rand Paul has done now is not that. Oh, and I should have said. And of course, Ron Paul voted against his own resolution in that House Foreign Affairs Committee vote. What Rand Paul has done here is not that. He has introduced a declaration of war into the Senate, and he supports it, and he's going to vote for it. And it's not an authorization for the president to use force of the kind that we've had that are more or less just kind of spending bills that we've had since the days of Harry Truman when he launched the war in Korea under the UN mandate without Congress at all. Just sent the troops in the middle of the night. This is a real-ass declaration of war like the kind that Congress last passed against Japan and Germany in World War II. This is no police action. This is a war against a real country, Paul is declaring. Now, I lean toward the idea that you want to get technical. Yeah, the Islamic State is a state. It's sort of the shell of one, and they're working on it. But, yeah, they have a monopoly on force in their territory. I don't know. Not that they control their own skies. But, no, that just means they're a state at war. That's all. And point being that Rand Paul is building them up as a more powerful force than any force we fought since the Nazis. Right? That gives them a greater stature than Al-Qaeda, a greater stature than the Taliban, a greater stature than Saddam Hussein, for that matter. It's the same thing. And I've been telling you all along since 2001, I've been saying this to my friends, family, and since 2002 on the radio anyway. Kind of had a couple years without a radio show there, but at least since 2002, I've been saying, obviously, we should be playing down the strength of these guys, calling them cowards and weaklings and criminals, and then prosecuting them in federal court. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, that guy's lower scum than a crackhead mugger. He's nothing. He's dirt. He's just human enough for us to give him the death penalty in a court of law in New York State. Goodbye, Mr. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. And instead, what do we got? A military commission where he's won the right to wear a camouflage hunting jacket. As though he's a general in a war. As though he's a commander
in a military instead of the lowest criminal scumbag scum of the earth. Because, of course, that fits the American Empire's narrative that Al-Qaeda all along, even when they were only 200 men, that they were the new Soviet. They dominated a third of the planet with their Islamo-fascist caliphate, and we had to stop them before they turned the whole world green. Like some ridiculous John Bircher map from days of old. And so it fit their purposes to build these guys up into such a gigantic threat. Same thing in the Iraq War, Iraq War II, where they built Zawahiri up when he was only one of many, many fighters. And yet they blamed every attack on, did I say Zawahiri? I'm sorry, I meant Zarqawi. Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. They blamed every attack on him so that they could pretend it was just the terrorists who are resisting us, the suicide bomber crazies, not actual just local Iraqi resistance fighters who don't take too kindly to being occupied by a bunch of North Americans, killing them and their family and oppressing them and etc. and foisting the Iranian parties on them, etc. And so they built Zarqawi up into, you know, helped build his legend into a giant thing. He's the guy who founded what we now call the Islamic State, Al-Qaeda in Iraq. In the same way, because it serves their purpose. And now Rand Paul wants to give them the ultimate recognition by declaring war. And you see what he's doing here? He's half-assing what his father did. His father wasn't being too cute by half. His father was calling them on the carpet for being hypocrites back in 2002. You want to declare war against Saddam Hussein's Iraq? Declare war against Saddam Hussein's Iraq then, you weasels. Now, Rand Paul is saying, yes, the president, if he's going to wage war in Iraq and Syria, he needs authority from Congress to do so. That's right. But then is he against it? No, he's for it. He's out ahead of John McCain on this. John McCain could and probably will say, well, I'm not for a declaration of war. The president has the authority. He's got an authorization to use military force, this and that. Tell us, Rand Paul, what all laws in America will fall silent when a real declaration of war kicks in? And who among Rand Paul's fans believes that he has the authority, that a declaration of war can have a time limit on it or forbid the movement of troops in it? You can have a war, but without ground troops, without other special authorization? Yeah, right. Just like George Bush needs a second resolution back in 2003, right? Hell, even Ron Paul would tell you that the president moves the troops. The Congress has the authority to make him stop moving them entirely, but they don't have the authority to tell him where to move them and when. In that sense, he's the commander in chief. You declare war, and with a time limit? You must defeat the Islamic State, but within this time period? And then what if they fail and the Islamic State is still there? I mean, who came up with this crap for Rand Paul to do this? Even Justin Raimondo was quoted in U.S. News and World Report saying, come on, man, this is ridiculous. You can't have a time limit and a troop limit in a declaration of war. So what'll happen is we'll get the declaration of war, and then but the rest of it, those pretended restrictions won't last. Meanwhile, our Secretary of State is saying this war is going to take years and years. And meanwhile, the Pentagon says ISIS is training terrorists in Libya right now. Does this declaration apply to ISIS in Libya and in Sinai? In an empire where Congress knows nothing, the ubiquitous DC think tank is all. And the Israel lobby and their neocon allies must own a dozen. Well, Americans have a lobby in Washington, too. It's called the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. They advocate for us on Capitol Hill. Join CNI to demand an end to the U.S.-sponsored occupation of the Palestinians and an end to our government's destructive empire in the Middle East. That's the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm doing too many things at once while I'm trying to host a radio show. Hey, welcome back to it. I'm Scott Horton. Full interview archives are at scotthorton.org. More than 3,500 of them now. Going back to 2003 there at scotthorton.org. And you can laugh and while you watch me heckle the world there at twitter.com/ScottHortonShow. All right. So our first guest today is Cade Crockford, and she is the director of the Technology for Liberty program at the ACLU of Massachusetts. And you can follow her on Twitter, too, One Cade on Twitter. She raises hell on there all damn day, as bad as me or worse, maybe. PrivacySOS.org is the website, PrivacySOS.org. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing real good. Really appreciate you coming on the show. And I really appreciate you being all wrapped up in the case of the Boston bombing. I haven't followed it. It's nice to know that there's somebody as sharp as you paying very close attention to all the developments and keeping up for us. And the latest is some pretty surprising, maybe surprising, pretty shocking, some level of something eyebrow-raising, where the government has changed their story to a great extent about a very important part of their narrative of the Tsarnaev brothers and the lead-up to the Boston bombing. And so I guess I'm not sure exactly where to start. I guess, with the headline, can you tell us, remind us who the Tsarnaev brothers are and tell us who is Ibrahim Todashev?
Sure. So the Tsarnaevs are the two guys, the FBI and the U.S. attorney here in Massachusetts, Carmen Ortiz, infamous for prosecuting Aaron Schwartz until he killed himself, the internet freedom activist. Carmen Ortiz and the FBI say that two Chechen immigrants to the United States, Tamerlan Tsarnaev and his little brother, Jahar Tsarnaev, blew up the Boston Marathon in April of 2013. And Ibrahim Todashev was a Chechen immigrant as well, who was apparently, we are told, friends with Tamerlan, the elder of the accused in the marathon bombing case. We woke up to some very strange news. The country in May 2013, just a few weeks after the marathon bombing, to learn that Ibrahim Todashev, who we didn't even know existed at that point, had been killed overnight by the FBI in his apartment in Orlando, Florida. And right away, the FBI spun sort of magical tales about issuing conflicting reports to the press saying that Ibrahim Todashev had attacked a Massachusetts state trooper and FBI agent from Boston who were in his apartment interviewing him in the middle of the night with a broomstick. He attacked them with a sword. The FBI went through a number of explanations of what happened that night until finally settling on a story that they put out in the FBI's final report of that shooting, obviously finding that the agent acted appropriately in shooting Ibrahim Todashev, riddling his body with bullets. He was shot, I think, 8 times. A couple of those shots in the back, one in the top of the head. So, like every other FBI shooting, and that's not hyperbole. Every time the FBI shoots someone, the FBI clears itself of wrongdoing. Like every other FBI shooting, the FBI found that the agent, in this case, a guy called Aaron McFarlane, who had actually been an Oakland police officer who was the target of a number of lawsuits for sort of vindictive, brutal behavior out in Oakland. He moved to Boston and became an FBI agent in the Boston office, went down to Florida and killed Ibrahim Todashev, who we were told at the time was potentially responsible with Tamerlan Tsarnaev, again, the elder brother who was killed a couple days after the marathon bombing by authorities in a bizarre shootout in Watertown, Massachusetts, accused of the Boston Marathon bombing. Just about found guilty, at least in the public's mind. We learned right after the FBI killed his friend Ibrahim Todashev in Florida that the government suspected that Todashev and the elder Tsarnaev had participated in a very gruesome triple murder on the 10th anniversary of 9/11, September 11th, 2011, in Waltham, Massachusetts, in which Tamerlan Tsarnaev's best friend and two other people, the three of them drug dealers, basically, were found with their throats slit to the point where their heads were almost decapitated, with lots of marijuana dumped on their bodies and thousands of dollars cash found in the house. It's a totally bizarre murder. Very rarely do things like that happen ever in this country, let alone in a very quiet suburb like Waltham. This was on a residential street in the dude's apartment. And as I said, Tamerlan was best friends with one of the deceased. So after we woke up to the news that Ibrahim Tadashev had been killed by the FBI in the middle of the night a few weeks after the Boston Marathon bombings, 2 years and some change after the, or I guess just under 2 years after the September 11th triple murder in Waltham, we were told that the authorities thought that Ibrahim Tadashev had killed those people with his friend Tamerlan Tsarnaev. Now, immediately after those allegations were anonymously leaked to the press by officials, CARE, the Center for American Islamic Relations in Florida, announced that they had evidence that Tadashev was not in Massachusetts at the time of the 2011 murders and that they would be producing that evidence in a report that has never come out, unfortunately. But there was a lot of shady stuff that happened immediately after Tadashev's killing, which was shady as well. And you can read all about all of that shady stuff and listen to it even in a report that a journalist in Boston named Susan Zalkin did for Boston Magazine and then was picked up by This American Life, the NPR production. They did an hour-long program on what happened in the wake of Tadashev's killing by the FBI. His girlfriend was seized by the Department of Homeland Security and summarily deported after speaking to Susan Zalkin, a journalist here in Boston, who went down to Florida to talk to her. A number of his friends, basically everybody who knew the guy except for his former mother-in-law, who was a former U.S. Army employee, were deported from the United States. Some of them arrested, held in solitary confinement for lengthy periods. But it's really quite bizarre that the FBI goes down to Florida, kills the person we are told is the sole living witness to a gruesome, yet-to-be-solved triple murder in Waltham, Massachusetts, that predated the marathon bombings by about 2 years, for which we are told Tamerlan Tsarnaev is partially responsible, and then proceeds to deport basically everyone he knew. So it really looks like a cleanup operation. What they're trying to hide, we still don't know.
Right. Well, what a mess. So, first of all, when it comes to the actual night of the death of Tadashev here, this interrogation and all that, from all that you've seen or know, and I'm sorry, I'm asking you to speculate. It'd be an educated guess, I guess. Does it look to you like this was just a hit on a guy who knew the guy who did the bombing and just tied that loose end, or that some kind of fight broke out during the interrogation and the cops just went too far and killed them like they like to do every day, or what happened there? Do you know? Oh, crap, and now the music's playing. We got to take a break. Well, anyway, we'll be right back, everybody, with Cade Crockford. She's one Cade on Twitter. You ought to follow her there. The blog is privacysos.org, and this article is called "Shocking New Information in Tsarnaev Case Casts Doubt on Official Story About the Killing of Ibrahim Tadashev." We'll be back in just a sec. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Like I told you before, the Future Freedom Foundation at FFF.org represents the best of the libertarian movement. Led by the fearless Jacob Hornberger, FFF writers James Bovard, Sheldon Richmond, Wendy McElroy, Anthony Gregory, and many more write the op-eds and the books, host the events, and give the speeches that are changing our world for the better. Help support the Future Freedom Foundation. Subscribe to their magazine, The Future of Freedom. Or to contribute, just look for the big red donate button at the top of FFF.org. Peace and freedom. Thank you.
All right, you guys, I'm Scott Horton. Welcome back. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Coming up, Jason Ditz and Chris Woods. Right now, talking with Cade Crockford from the ACLU of Massachusetts. And I don't know what that might sound like to you, but I beseech you, check out her great blog, privacysos.org. Follow her on Twitter. It's one Cade with a K, Cade.
on Twitter there. And so, I'm sorry, we were interrupted by the break, and I was asking you to speculate, which ain't really fair, but I'm just trying to understand as best I can. You got the FBI, the government says that the Boston bomber and his buddy did this murder. They're in the middle of, they say, getting him to confess to that murder. This is one that took place a year and a half, a robbery murder that took place a year and a half before the bombing. And then somehow they kill this guy in the middle of him writing this confession. And now they're saying, oh, yeah, you know what? We never said that Zarnaev, the Boston bomber, had anything to do with this murder. Are they still even claiming that Todashev did? And then, I'm sorry, because the original question was, do you think they just went there to kill his friend or some kind of fight broke out or I don't know. And maybe you know, but I think I'm just asking you to guess at this point.
Yeah, well, that's a lot of questions. But to start with the question about what happened that night in Todashev's apartment, I have no idea. I mean, I wasn't there. But what I can say is that there's a lot of fishy stuff surrounding his killing. First off, the FBI is not usually in the business of going to people's homes in the middle of the night and interviewing them until, you know, midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning. That's exactly what happened here. Two Massachusetts state troopers, one of whom works on a violent gang and fugitive task force. So basically this guy's job is to go around the country finding people who don't want to be found and haul them back to Massachusetts to face prosecution. And the other, who was, we think, in charge of the state police side of the murder investigation having to do with that triple homicide in Waltham in 2011, those two state troopers and this guy, Aaron McFarlane, the former Oakland cop who became a Boston FBI agent, went down to Orlando, and they said, you know, we had to rush down there. We had to rush down there because we heard that Ibrahim Tadashev was going to get on a plane and go back to Russia, and we had to get down there before he left. Well, that already stinks, because if the FBI wants to stop someone from leaving the country, it is not hard for them to do that. This guy is not, he was not a U.S. citizen. He's Muslim, right? So he already, the story sort of stinks. There's no reason why the FBI would have to rush down there to interview this guy under hasty circumstances like they did, unless I think there was something fishy going on. So they do. They rush down to Florida. They go to this guy's house to meet with him in the middle of the night, basically, or, you know, in the evening and last until the middle of the night. And they do so even though they know that Ibrahim Tadashev was an MMA fighter, a very powerful guy who could probably kill those FBI and state troopers with his bare hands. So even though they know this, they don't put handcuffs on him. They don't bring him into a secure place where they can interview him with plenty of backup around in case he flips out. So that's pretty fishy, too. And as far as Mike German, a guy who used to work with us at the ACLU, who before that was an FBI agent, has said, it's not standard practice. You know, if the FBI had any good sense and was following its own policies, if they know that somebody is physically very powerful, they're going to do all that's necessary to make sure that he's in a secure environment before they start asking him questions that might agitate him significantly, which is what happened, we hear. So the official story is that, like you said, Tadashev was sitting down in his apartment writing out a confession to the 2011 triple murder in Waltham. There are a lot of problems with the confession. Immediately after it was leaked, a journalist, Susan Falcon, again, pointed out that some of the stuff that was written in that confession did not conform with the crime scene. So already that was a little bit fishy. But like you said, now, over a year later, we hear from the federal government in a court filing, in the trial against the younger Tsarnaev brother, who's facing the death penalty here in Massachusetts, we hear that the government, in fact, has no evidence to suggest that Tadashev and Tamerlan Tsarnaev were involved in that triple murder in Waltham. So the FBI says, immediately after Tadashev is killed, that he was in the middle of writing this confession implicating himself and Tsarnaev in these murders, at which point he flipped out and attacked an FBI agent, and basically he got shot a bunch of times, and that was it. He was killed. was found to be justifiable force, like I said, and, you know, the FBI made a lot of this notion that he was penning a confession to these murders, implicating Tsarnaev. In response to your question about whether or not they went down there to kill him, I don't know, but we do have one bizarre hint to answer that question, which is a text message, a series of text messages that the law enforcement agents who were in that room sent each other the day after his killing. So the day after, one of the cops sends a text message to another one, and this is on my website. We have these materials because there was a state's attorney's report in Florida looking into this to see if there were, they were going to bring any manslaughter or homicide charges against the FBI agent who killed Tadashev. Of course, they didn't. But in the report, they highlight some of these text messages, and one of them says, that was supposed, well, one says, well done this week, men, well done, enjoy some time at home, we'll talk soon. And then the next message says, that was supposed to say, well done, men, we all got through it, and we're now heading home, great work. So if I was a state trooper assigned to investigate a gruesome, unsolved triple murder in a quiet suburb of Boston that occurred 2 years prior, and I went down to Florida to interview someone who I thought might be a main suspect in that murder investigation, and then he ended up dead, I don't think I would think of that as great work. And so that text message has always puzzled me, that these law enforcement officials thought that what they did there was great work, given that they killed what I think we are meant to believe is this was the sole remaining living witness to those murders, someone who we were also told was one of the government's main suspects.
And then so when they say that now they don't think that Tsarnaev, the Boston bomber, did that murder at all, is that more credible to you than their implication that he had done it, which they had insisted all this time? Because I don't know which government story to believe.
Yeah, right. So there's a lot of that in this case, actually. The government saying one thing one day and then the next another day. But I think what's really interesting about the distinction between what they said initially and what they're saying in court now is where they said it and how. So there's another example of this exact same problem in the Marathon case, and that has to do with the building of the bombs that blew up the Marathon. Now, right after the Marathon attacks, the officials who are investigating made anonymous leaks to journalists all over the place, CNN, et cetera, local press, telling them, not just vaguely alluding to this, but explicitly telling the press that officials had concrete evidence that the bombs were built in Tamerlan Tsarnaev's Cambridge apartment. They said they had concrete evidence. Explosives powder from multiple places in the house. These were anonymous leaks, so we don't know the names of the officials who actually said these things to reporters. The reporters, being credulous of the government, printed this stuff as if it was fact. We can see how dangerous that credulity is, because a year later, so this was in May 2013, a year later in May 2014, Carmen Ortiz, her office, writes in a brief in the Tsarnaev case that, in fact, not only was there no evidence found in Tamerlan Tsarnaev's home that the bombs were built there, but that the FBI thinks that they were not built at Tamerlan's home, and furthermore, that they do not know who built the bombs. So this is an admission made in court, right? I mean, court documents are things that are not read by very many people. Hardly anyone is pouring through the numerous motions filed in this court case and picking out inconsistencies in them. People do read blazing headlines on CNN, and in a way, what the anonymous officials are leaking to the press in 2013 becomes the truth. It becomes the story. And even if a year later officials say the exact opposite in court, it's never corrected in the mainstream. So the same thing happened, really, with this Tadashev issue.
Right.
We were immediately told that Tadashev was responsible for these murders with Tamerlan Tsarnaev. And then in court, because the Tsarnaev defense is trying to make an argument that basically in order to get the little brother off of the death penalty, to get him life in prison. They're trying to make an argument that Tamerlan was an overbearing, violent, and scary influence on his younger brother, and that he basically convinced his younger brother and pressured him to do the bombings, and that it wasn't, you know, Jahar didn't do it of his own volition. In order to demonstrate this, they want to be able to show in court that not only did Tamerlan kill those three people on Waltham in 2011, but Jahar knew it, and that therefore he was really intimidated, because obviously if your brother killed his best friend, slit his throat, almost cut his head off, he's a pretty seriously guy not to be effed with, and you do not want to disobey him, right? So in this context, this is the context in which the government's startling admission comes that they have no evidence that Tamerlan Tsarnaev was involved in those murders. Now, just last week, a federal judge ruled on these motions. What happened was the defense said, we want to see the evidence that the government has in its Waltham murder investigation so we can use that in court to show that Tamerlan was an overbearing influence on his brother. The government was saying, no, we're not showing you any of that stuff. And part of the reason we're not going to show you is that we don't have any evidence that Tamerlan was involved in those murders. This despite the fact that they said a year prior in public that Todashev was penning a confession implicating Tsarnaev when he was killed. So that's why what's recently gone on in court cast so much doubt and suspicion, I think, on what the FBI has been saying publicly. Now, which of those things is true, we still don't know.
It seems like a giant pile of BS just for, you know, part of the motive argument in a case that'll probably be pled out anyway, right? I mean, the younger brother's going to do what his older brother said because his older brother is bigger and older and is a professional fighter and must have beaten his younger brother's ass 1,000 times in their lives. And so they could make the same argument without any of this stuff at all, without the cutting a guy's head off and all this stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know this because I'm not privy to any secret information that the defense is using or any of their strategy, but just judging on what they've been doing, from the public stuff, from the court filings, it seems to me that it might be a way to try to get the government to plea, because it sure seems like the government is hiding something, right? And so if the defense says, we want to see access to this information, and this information is something that the government very much does not want to disclose, it could be an attempt to try to move forward towards a plea, to push the government to plea, because I think Carmen Ortiz really does want to go to trial, which confuses me in part because a trial will have the effect of airing, I think, a lot of dirty laundry that maybe the FBI does not want aired. And I think that some of these motions, especially the motion to get input into the record, some of the information about the Waltham investigation might be related to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and again, it's unfair, and I'm asking you to speculate, but you alluded to it, so I'll ask you, what sort of dirty laundry do you suspect might be involved here?
Well, I mean, just among one thing for sure is that the Jahar Tsarnaev defense team submitted a brief in court last year that said that they had evidence to show that Tamerlan Tsarnaev was approached multiple times by the FBI to become an asset. So if he did become an asset, that would not look very good for the FBI. If one of their own informants or assets ended up committing a gruesome terrorist attack in the United States, I think that would be something that the FBI would not like to be made public. And again, I don't know if that's true. I don't know if it's true that he became an informant, but, you know, federal public defenders, the people who are defending Jahar Tsarnaev, are no conspiracy theorists. They are not, Alex Jones types. They are these federal public defender positions are highly sought after among the best attorneys in the country. These are very serious people who have very serious reputations to maintain and would not make such a claim in court if they didn't have evidence to back it up. So I think there's something to that.
Sure. Well, and we've seen that Trevor Aronson's great journalism in his book, The Terror Factory, and of course the ACLU itself has done massive studies that we've talked with other of your colleagues on the show about in the past, about all the FBI entrapment jobs. Certainly well north of 50 now, where people were outright stung into these bogus terrorism plots. And that's not including just bogus charges for donating to charity or whatever, but actual entrapments. And so it seems within the realm of possibility that even if they didn't recruit the guy, that they sure tried a few times.
That's right.
Even within the realm of possibility, I'm not saying I've seen anything to indicate this. I don't know. That they wanted to trick him into doing something, and he did this. So I don't know. It's a fair question to ask if you read Trevor Aronson's book, for sure.
That's right. And not only just that, it's not just the brief that Tsarnaev's lawyers filed saying that they have evidence that he was approached to become an FBI informant, but Chuck Grassley, the senator, Republican senator, actually wrote a public letter to the FBI just before Robert Mueller left his position in 2013, in October 2013, asking very publicly a number of questions which I think the FBI did not want to answer. Among them was that question, did you ever approach Tamerlan to become an informant, and if not, why not? And I think that second question is a really good one. I mean, people need to remember that the FBI admits that it investigated Tamerlan Tsarnaev for 3 months in the summer of 2011, just before those Waltham murders. And it is, as anybody who has read Trevor's book or paid any attention to what the FBI has been doing for the past 10 years, it is FBI policy to ask Muslims to become informants. And so I think Chuck Grassley's questions are good ones. Did you ask him to become an informant? And if not, why not, since that's your standard operating procedure?
Right. Yeah, that's definitely a great follow-up there. And with that, I'm sorry, I can't follow up any further. I've got to let you go. We're way over time here, and we got to move on. But thank you so much for coming back on the show, Cade. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
All right, y'all. That's Cade Crockford. She is, let me get the title right, at the ACLU in Massachusetts, director of the Technology for Liberty program. And she keeps a great blog, including many very interesting in-depth entries on the Boston bombing at privacysos.org. That's privacysos.org. Hey, everybody. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. If you're like me, then you're right all the time, surrounded by people in desperate need of correction. Well, we can't all have a radio show, but we can all get anti-government propaganda to stick on the back of our trucks. Check out LibertyStickers.com. Categories include anti-war, empire, police state, libertarian, Ron Paul, gun rights, founders quotes, and of course, the stupid election. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Headphones back on. Hey, I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I got Jason Ditz online. Hey, Jason.
Hi, Scott.
How are you doing, dude?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm doing real good, and especially now I got you on the line. Very happy to have you here. I've been meaning to have you on all week long. Everybody, by the way, just finished, only a few moments ago, finished wrapping up that interview with Cade Crockford on the Boston bombing. Had to go overtime into the break there. So the full archive will be there with the rest of them at scotthorton.org/interviews. You won't want to miss the end of that one. All right, so Jason, man, I have so many things to ask you about, but I'm going to have to narrow it down because there's only so much time in a show. First of all, we got to talk about Israel, and I guess we'll start at the top with the politics. Can you please tell me about the end of the Netanyahu coalition and the beginning of what's next?
Well, sure. It's something that's been coming for a while, as anyone who's followed Israeli politics knows. Israel's had this sort of center-right, far-right coalition government since January of last year. And it's had members that have been at each other's throats pretty much from the beginning. So it was only a matter of time before something split them up. What ultimately did it was this Jewish nation-state bill, which... The original version pushed the idea of putting in the basic laws, which is sort of the Israeli equivalent of the Constitution, that Israel is a Jewish nation state. That version also included a guarantee of equal rights for minorities in sort of a vague way. Former Justice Minister Zippy Livni, who's one of the moderates, blocked the bill, saying that Israel has always defined itself as a Jewish and democratic state and always tried to balance between the two, which sometimes hasn't been so easy and sometimes hasn't been so successful, but defining it strictly as a Jewish state really undermines its claims to being a democracy, and indeed its more ridiculous claims of being the only democracy in the Middle East. So she blocked it. Netanyahu reintroduced the bill, taking out even the pretense of equal rights for minorities, announced he was going to push it through the cabinet, fired Livni, fired Yair Lapid, who was another moderate cabinet member who opposed the bill, and it's essentially collapsed the government. Now Israel has disbanded its parliament, dissolved its parliament for the term. Elections weren't supposed to be until 2017. Now they're going to be on March 17th. So it's finally the straw that broke the camel's back here.
Yeah. Wow. So, boy, it's a good thing I have you for a cheat sheet. I hadn't even gotten around to reading this. So I knew that the coalition had fallen apart, and I knew they were trying to pass this Jewish nationality law, but I didn't realize that it was the language of the law was what broke up the coalition. And I just want to make sure I understand you right. You're saying that Livni and another guy both opposed the law from the left, but the rest of the cabinet opposed the law from the right, or they were okay with it, the people to the right of Netanyahu, like Lieberman and Bennett, they were okay with it, even though it had some lip service as to the civil liberties protections of the minority?
Right. They were okay with the version that had the lip service to civil liberties. That got taken out at any rate when Netanyahu reintroduced the bill, so they were even more okay with it then.
But then at that point, Livni said, "I'm out," and that was the end of that?
Right. Livni and Lapid. And Lapid's party, he was the finance minister. His party was actually one of the top three in the coalition. So,
which is his party, by the way?
Yesh Atid.
Oh, okay. I don't know that one.
They were just formed for the 2013 election. They were originally formed to be sort of a new version of the sort of centrist free market party that used to exist in Israel, which was run by his father. But after the election, it sort of became less and less clear what the party actually stood for, because they ended up joining the coalition alongside Bennett, supposedly because Bennett was going to weaken the ultra-Orthodox hold on the rabbinate.
Mm. Yeah, that's an interesting split between the secular right nationalists and the religious right. You'd think that they would put their differences aside, but guess not.
Right, and that's going to be a big problem going forward in the elections, because it's unthinkable for the ultra-Orthodox parties to be in a coalition with Lieberman. I mean, they despise Lieberman, and Lieberman despises them.
Well, thank God for that, because otherwise it'd just be a slam dunk at this point that without Livni and Lapid and their parties, that what's left of Kadima, I guess, and this other new party, that the coalition just be moving to the right. But you're saying, no, they got enough problems on the right that may not be the case.
Right. And the early polling shows that it might still go that way, but there's so much anger between these different far-right parties, particularly the secular versus religious right parties, that it's going to be really tough to put together any sort of coalition that everyone agrees to.
Mm-hmm. Well, and now, you know, I want to mention to you this thing that I read in the Jewish Daily Forward that was a really smart, I think it was just, you know, their editorial board kind of essay rather than, you know, with one person named on it. But the point of it was that this law is not for the majority, and I guess it's in jeopardy now, this law, but it's not for the majority. They already rule. They already know it's a Jewish state. They're living it. This is a law for the minority. This is a law to stick it in the face of the minority that this country is not yours. And then they make the obvious parallel. It's the Jewish Daily Forward, an American publication, after all. What if they declared America a white Protestant state? How would you like that, liberal Jews of America, who, you know, are, what, 2% of the population? Would that make you feel very comfortable? Well, that's what they're doing in Israel right now. As though the Muslims and the Druze and the Christians of Israel, never mind the occupied territories, don't know that they're third and fourth class citizens, you know, as it is already. They got to be reminded that, no, Jewishness predominates over democracy. Enough of the pretense.
Right, and the fact that they're all, you know, second and third class citizens, which nobody really questioned in the first place, I think is less the issue for a lot of the centrist Israeli parties. I don't think Libni and Lapid have tremendous problems with that fact,
right?
Because Israeli centrists are quite a bit different from centrists in most countries. Centrist is kind of a relative term.
Yeah, absolutely. Even the Labor Party, I mean, they're run by Ehud Barak. So, or I guess they were, he retired now or whatever, but that's his party anyway. So, you know, they're as militarist as Likud or anybody else.
Right. And I believe it's Isaac Herzog runs Labor now, and he's a little more to the left than Barak was. But, the real issue was this sort of putting it in the basic laws as a Jewish state and not Jewish/democratic state. I think that was really the sticking point here.
Or just leaving it alone, right?
Right.
It's already, as they said in the argument, right, as you cited Livni saying there, it's always been a Jewish and democratic. Now, they ethnically cleansed all the non-Jews out of there so that they'd have their 80-20 super-duper majority, but it is what it is, at least. But to now just renounce the democracy part, that leaves them with what? Sectarian nationalism? You know?
Right.
Bad old days, medieval times? All right, we'll be right back. It's Jason Ditz. I want to ask you all about the Iraq and Syria wars, too, here in just a minute. News.antiwar.com. I didn't even give you a proper introduction. It's the great Jason Ditz. News.antiwar.com. He's covering everything. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com.
The military-industrial complex. The disastrous rise of misplaced power.
Hey, all Scott Horton here. I'd like for you to read this book, The War State, by Michael Swanson. America's always gone to war a lot, though in older times it would disarm for a bit between each one. But in World War II, the U.S. built a military and intelligence apparatus so large, it ended up reducing the former constitutional government to an almost ceremonial role and converting our economy into an engine of destruction. In The War State, Michael Swanson does a great job telling the sordid history of the rise of this national security state, relying on important first-hand source material, but writing for you and me. Find out how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy all alternately empowered and fought to control this imperial beast, and how the USA has gotten to where it is today, corrupt, bankrupt, soaked in blood, despised by the world. The War State by Michael Swanson, available at Amazon.com and at Audible.com. Or just click the logo in the right-hand margin at scotthorton.org.
We should take nothing for granted.
All right, you guys. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Jason Ditz. He's at news.antiwar.com. He's the news director there at antiwar.com. He's the most important part of antiwar.com. News.antiwar.com. Yeah, it's a judgment call and I'm making. All right. Listen, so one last thing. I think I assumed a thing that I don't know for sure, but I think maybe I'm right. Jason, was I right that because of the breakup of the government now and the call for new elections and everything over there in Israel, that the new law is actually stalled, or it's sailing on through anyway, or what's the status with that?
Right. It's probably going to be stalled until after the new election.
Okay. I think I was just assuming that, but thanks for clarifying that. Okay, and now, you know, I almost don't believe it, but I know that you wrote it, so I do. Planned Israeli bill would revoke... Oh, and it's about Israel, so yeah, I do. Planned Israeli bill would revoke residency for, quote, bad people and their relatives, would give broad authority to Interior Ministry to expel Arabs. This is from November the 23rd at news.antiwar.com. Please explain.
Well, this sort of came about, and this bill hasn't passed either, so whether it will or not with the government splitting up remains to be seen. This was another thing that came out in the middle of sort of the crackdown on protests in occupied East Jerusalem, the government condemning everyone as rioters. And the bill was initially sort of pushed as an idea by the mayor of Jerusalem, who came up with this, you know, we need to get rid of the bad people, quote, in a speech. And the bill is incredibly broad because it, you know, it covers quote-unquote terrorism, but it includes anyone who was involved in a riot, which is to say anyone that's been involved in any Arab protest in East Jerusalem. I mean, basically, they've labeled every single one a riot, whether anything happened or not. People who've thrown rocks, which, of course, includes children. People who incite, which is also an incredibly broad topic. And I mean, that covers a vast chunk of the population to begin with, but it also includes their families. And it doesn't really say how broad that definition is either. So is it their extended family? Is it just their immediate family or what? I mean, basically this law would allow, if it passes, would allow the Israeli Interior Ministry at its discretion to just wholesale revoke residency permits for entire neighborhoods in East Jerusalem and basically depopulate the area.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this, if I can figure out a good way to ask it. Now that the whole Kerry thing has fallen apart, what I think everybody, even in D.C. and New York and all the, you know, fancy places that they write, agreed that, well, that's it for the two-state solution. No more pretending that the Israeli government is ever going to negotiate in good faith for an independent Palestinian state. I wonder if that's changed the conversation very much in Israeli politics about, well, so just what is the future of the West Bank? I mean, obviously, they're, you know, moving forward at all times in East Jerusalem and in the rest of the West Bank. But have they sort of shifted into a higher gear? Is there sort of an understanding, you know, like we talked about before, about that law, that, well, we're just going to have to ditch the democracy thing because we can't pretend that it's an 80-20 split. It's much more like a 50-50 split. The Jews might even be in a minority now if you count the West Bank and Gaza Strip and the occupied territories, the Golan Heights, and all the non-Jews inside Israel, quote-unquote, proper there. They might not even be the majority at all anymore. And I just wonder whether they're talking about that. Okay, fine, now it's time to go ahead and annex the West Bank and then deal with the new reality. Stop pretending that, you know, it's a slow-motion process. We're at the end of the process. Now it belongs to the state of Israel, that kind of thing, or what?
Well, I think that certainly that's how Bennett and the far right see it, and the more far right portions of Likud also see it. But I think a lot of the other parties are, particularly with this long-standing threat of early elections, have been trying to position themselves in different ways for the sake of gaining votes this time around, because the polls still show that a two-state solution is, quite popular in Israel. Most Israelis are fine with the idea, particularly supportive if it ends all the violence that is constantly going on over these settlements. But one of the particularly big surprises is Lieberman, who for decades has been one of the most staunch anti-two-state solution people. He's come out in the past week in favor of a two-state solution now, saying, well, and it's not an ideal two-state solution from the more moderate perspective, because he's coming up with the idea of ethnically cleansing the rest of Israel by expelling the minorities into the new Palestinian state. But the fact that he's even open to the idea that, well, maybe some of this land is going to not be part of Israel in the future is a big change.
And that goes back to that right-wing split between the secularists and the religious types there, because he doesn't care so much about Judea and Samaria. He's more interested in playing real-world politics than superstition.
Right.
As brutal as he is and as willing as he is, as you just explained, to violate people's rights to get his way. His way at least makes more sense in an evil way, but still, you know, rational.
Right. He's much less interested in keeping this greater Israel conceit going. And he even says that it's probably time to abandon the notion of greater Israel, that Israel is just going to be expanding into this enormous state territorially, and to focus instead on unity, which is to say getting rid of the minorities inside of Israel itself. Because it's fairly obvious you can't easily do both. I mean, I guess theoretically you could genocide everybody else, but that's not going to sell very well, even for the constantly pro-U.S., pro-Israel U.S. is not going to just sit by while Israel does God knows what to these people. And there's already tension about the settlements. So I think asked to choose between expelling the minorities and continuing to expand Israel's borders, he chose the former.
Yeah. All right, well, I'm sorry we're out of time. I wanted to ask y'all about the war, too, but Israel's wars are ours, so.
Yeah.
That's the great Jason Ditz, everybody. Thanks very much for your time again.
Sure, thanks for having me.
All right, y'all. News.antiwar.com. Read everything he writes. He writes all day, every day about everything. News.antiwar.com. Back in just a sec. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audio book of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. All right, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Next up is our old friend Chris Woods, formerly with the Bureau for Investigative Journalism. This one's at Foreign Policy. Pentagon in denial about civilian casualties of U.S. airstrikes in Iraq and Syria. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Chris?
I'm good, Scott. Thanks for having me back on.
Very happy to have you here. And I'm sorry, I meant to have a tab pulled up and Googled. What's the name of your new book coming out?
It's called Sudden Justice, America's Secret Drone Wars, and that's coming out in the spring in the U.S.
So,
quite a bit of work gone into that, but looking forward to that finally being out.
Yeah, me too. I've forgotten what circumstance I accidentally found that on Google the other day that saw that was coming out soon. Sudden Justice, very good. Okay, so, and now for people familiar, you already know, for people not familiar, Chris has done all this groundbreaking work, on the drone war, especially of the Obama years, but of the Bush years too. All the civilian casualties in the drone wars especially in Pakistan, but I guess in Yemen, Somalia, and the rest of it too. Am I correct?
That's right, yeah. And one of the things I do with the book is look at the more conventional wars like Iraq and Afghanistan, uh-huh. and how drones were rolled out there. And it's interesting, I managed to get special forces people to talk to me, for example, about Great. How they were using drones. So a lot of new stuff coming.
Yeah, Afghanistan is the drone war we never hear about. But, of course, they're killing people with drones all day in Afghanistan, right?
Absolutely. And in
fact, it's just not explicitly a drone war, so it doesn't get lumped in with that Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, like I just listed them.
Exactly. But in fact, targeted killings happen just as frequently in Afghanistan as they ever were in Pakistan. And it's just become a part of warfare now to assassinate on the battlefield. And one of the things I go into quite a lot in the book.
All right. Well, so now back to the Islamic State. And, you know, with all the headlines, the Islamic State, just like Al-Qaeda, it exists wherever people claim it. So it seems like we've got little franchises at least trying to pop themselves up in the Sinai Peninsula and Libya and et cetera like that. So I guess it can spread. But if we try to define it more narrowly as the, I think you've got to admit, it is a new country there in what was formerly Western Iraq and Eastern Syria, now the Islamic State. And the war that America has been waging there since, at least officially, since, August the 8th. How many civilians have been killed? How do you know?
Well, we're not really sure. That's one of the big problems that we have. I mean, when you talk to credible monitoring groups like Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which is tracking this on the Syrian side, or Iraq Body Count, or indeed Anti-War, that's been monitoring casualties, the numbers could be anywhere from maybe 50 civilians killed to maybe 120 plus civilians killed. One of the problems we've got is that the corroboration that we used to be able to rely on in these areas occupied by Islamic State has just fallen apart. And I, for this feature for Foreign Policy, I spoke with international news agencies in Baghdad, with reporters on the ground and so on, and a lot of those networks have gone. Or the people who work for the agencies, it's too dangerous for them to operate. The NGOs can't get in. So we often get claims of civilian casualties, and it's proving very, very hard to verify and follow through on that. It doesn't mean they're not happening. It just means that we can't be absolutely clear what is happening on the ground, which, as I talk about, means there should be a greater emphasis on the U.S. and its allies in telling us what's going on and saying when they get things wrong, as they inevitably will do.
Mm-hmm. Well, and they've said that they're changing the rules, that they had the very restrictive process that they have on Terror Tuesday when they pick out their signature strike targets and et cetera like that, in order to prevent civilian casualties. All the bending over backwards they assure us that they're doing, that your work basically proves otherwise. And they're saying, no, we got to loosen those rules because, you know, this war's so important that we got to go ahead and take even more risks of killing civilians. At the same time, as you're reporting here, that they're saying, yeah, and we're not even going to bother trying to keep up with compensating the survivors of the dead either.
Yeah, and I mean that's a really important point. By the end, the drone war in Pakistan, they'd evolved this rule of not striking unless there was a near certainty of no civilians to be killed. We can argue about what the CIA thinks a civilian is, but at least it was a positive step that they had that rule. But the National Security Council has been really clear that rule doesn't apply in this war, and of course it's because it's really a hot war. That we're involved in, the UK, United States, 10 other countries bombing in both Iraq and Syria, and they're treating it as a hot war, so they're not taking the same kind of care that they are with drone strikes in Yemen or Pakistan or even in Afghanistan today. But also, you know, many of the places that are being bombed are in cities and big towns in both Iraq and Syria. So a lot of reasons why we should be concerned about civilian casualties, significantly greater risk to civilians on the ground. But the noise coming out of the Pentagon, I mean, the Pentagon still insists that they've got no confirmation of a single civilian death in either Iraq or Syria. That's after more than 1,200 airstrikes in 4 months. And I don't think that's really a credible position for them to have, to be honest.
Well, and it seems like unless they kill Baghdadi, Caliph Ibrahim, and his, you know, top cabinet all sitting and meeting at their, Cobra headquarters or whatever, Cobra Command Center, then these pinpick strikes are useless in this war. Basically, all they can do is kill civilians, you know, even if it's just, you know, the remainder, if it's just the collateral damage or the civilians, that might as well be all they're doing is accomplishing the public relations goals of the Islamic State. You take out a stolen Humvee here and a stolen Humvee there, you're not changing the tide of anything.
I mean, they would argue that they are, and I, you know, I don't want to be in a position of arguing for or against, you know, the Pentagon's position here, but that, you know, certainly it's their position with so many airstrikes now, and it is a lot. I know it's often portrayed as there's not much happening in Iraq or Syria, but actually the number of airstrikes is pretty unprecedented outside, say, the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001 or Iraq in 2003. It's a lot of airstrikes going in there.
Yeah.
The US and the allies will argue that they're predominantly hitting Islamic State, Islamic State's ability to move. They're hitting command and control structures, bunkers, captured military equipment like Humvees, armored personnel carriers, and so on. And they argue that they're being effective. Whether they are or not, I mean, that's less clear. I mean, certainly we've not seen the Iraqi army really reoccupying territory yet. But I think it would be fair to say that the air intervention had some significant role in halting Islamic State's advance. And we know, for example, that Islamic State has changed their tactics on the ground. They're tending to attack strategically now on cloudy days, on days when US and allied aircraft can't operate. So there's, you know, clearly they're having effect. Clearly they're changing the way Islamic State is operating. But big picture stuff, I don't think any of us knows the answer to that, and probably not even the Pentagon yet, whether all of this is actually working. Syria, I think, is a whole other question. You know, Iraq is almost a sort of binary position. With Syria, with so many players involved in such a complicated situation on the ground, it's really not clear to me exactly what's going on in Syria and who's being. We know Islamic State's being targeted. We know the Khorasan group are being targeted. But, you know, by targeting them, do we make it easier for the Assad regime? Do we make it? I mean, it's really complicated there.
Right. Geez, I'm spacing on who it was that told me that. Was it Prothero? Mitchell Prothero? Or nah, I forget who it was that told me that al-Nusra, when they were in Syria, al-Nusra was under specific orders to leave the Americans alone. We don't want to pick that fight. But now,
yeah,
in bombing the so-called Khorasan group, that's all they're doing. They're bombing al-Nusra and al-Qaeda in Syria. So, you know, hey, in for a dime, in for a dozen, or whatever the hell the cliche is and all of that. As John Kerry said yesterday, it'll be war for years and years. As Rand Paul said, yeah, let's go ahead and declare it like we really mean it. So, anyway, more bad news on the other side of this break with the great Chris Woods in just a sec, y'all. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Chris Woods. He's the author of the new book, Sudden Justice, America's Secret Drone Wars, coming out next spring. I think he can pre-order here. Let me look. Yeah. Want to receive this? The day it comes out? Yeah, sign in. Sign up. Get it on Amazon. All right, he's got one. Came out yesterday at Foreign Policy, foreignpolicy.com. Pentagon in denial about civilian casualties of U.S. airstrikes in Iraq and Syria. I think I want to go back to what you said about, hey, this is the biggest air war since the invasion of Iraq, I think it was. Can you help us with some numbers there of just how many sorties are being flown against IS targets right now?
Yeah, so we're 4 months in, I think 16 weeks in now, and the last numbers the Pentagon put out said 1,145 strikes. Now, even that is kind of hiding a number, some fairly big numbers inside there. So what the Pentagon might report as two or three strikes, they might be hitting 20 targets. at a location. We had news of a mission the other week where seven nations took part, 20 aircraft. They hit 40 targets around Kirkuk, and that was only reported as three airstrikes. So there's a lot of stuff going on. And in terms of the number of airstrikes, Libya was intense for short bursts back in 2011, but I think over the whole period of Libya, not the same kind of intensity. So, yeah, it's an intense air war. And they're pulling more assets in, I suspect that's going to get a little bit more intense in the months ahead before it plateaus out. So, yeah, a lot of bombing.
Yeah. And then, and I guess we can see why it became necessary, at least the commanders thought there for a time, to call out the Apache helicopters from the Iraq airport there west of Baghdad in order to try to put down Islamic State, encroachments to the western border of the capital city there. And I guess they haven't had to, well, that we've heard of, they haven't had to launch the helicopters again, but you could see why they're worried if the Islamic State is really controlling all that land right up to within 15, 20 miles of the capital city.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, huge cities in Iraq are still under occupation. Tikrit, Mosul, pretty much all of Anbar province is all occupied by Islamic State, right the way up to the edges of Kirkuk, the Kurdish areas. This is a lot of territory that Islamic State controls. And the same into Syria as well. And as you said, the top of our chat, they are controlling a big part of Iraq and Syria now.
Well, and they can't really pay reparations to people when they can't get anywhere near them. They got to fly robots even to bomb them. They're so scared of getting near the place.
Yeah. I mean, I think the issue with compensation is interesting. I mean, American law is interesting. I didn't know this before I started researching this story. There was a law passed in 1942 called the Foreign Claims Act, which actually makes it the United States can't pay out for civilians it lawfully kills on the battlefield. This was an act passed during the Second World War. But what happened with Iraq and Afghanistan, Iraq the first time around in Afghanistan, is they realized that this was kind of undoing their own war aims. If they didn't compensate people for killing them, it was turning communities against them. So they evolved the system of no-fault payment. So the Pentagon would say, we don't accept responsibility for this, but we realize that bad has been done. We don't say that your relatives have been unlawfully killed, but because we feel bad about this, we're going to pay you. And it actually did go a long way to calming some of the tensions in some of the places that were getting bombed, where civilians were being killed. And, payments are $2,500-$3,000 for somebody killed, and the smaller payments for injuries, not a huge amount of money, but they make a difference in these in very poor countries. The problem we've got with Iraq and Syria now is they've gone back on that recent program, and they've said again, we're not going to pay any compensation. But of course, if you're fighting a war that everybody believes is to save the civilians of Iraq and Syria, but you're then saying, but if we kill them, we're not actually going to pay up for it. Where's the incentive really for the Allies to limit killing civilians? I mean, they would argue that's top of their list. But again, when I looked into this, I found that of the 12 allies bombing in Iraq and Syria, 8 of them, 2/3 of them, refused to say where they're bombing. So, and with 7 countries at a time taking place in some airstrikes, if civilians are killed or injured, how are their relatives supposed to know who the heck bombed them? Nobody's telling them. And even if they do find out, they're probably never going to get compensated anyway. I mean, there's been some criticism of the piece today. People saying, this doesn't matter compared to, the kind of bigger picture. This is just a small part. But you think, well, there are reasons we evolved this stuff first time around in Iraq and in Afghanistan. And we seem to be unlearning those lessons.
Yeah. Chris, if you go back to 2003 and even people from Saddam's own tribe saying, these guys, these Baathists were such bastards. Well, we're even willing to look the other way at all the innocent people you killed in this invasion just to get rid of them. They're so horrible. But that's it. You are all the way at the end of your permission slip as of right this instant, right? And we're talking still the spring of 2003. Your welcome is already worn out. You can't kill any more innocent people. And this was, you know, it's amazing to, it's an amazing testament to just what a bastard Saddam Hussein was that, you know, you had anti-war writers like Aaron Glantz quoting Sunnis, even members of the Iraqi army saying, yeah, we're happy that you invaded to get rid of this guy. I'm not saying I'm justifying it. I'm just saying that's their attitude. But that is an absolute miracle, right? Like Donald Rumsfeld couldn't have made up a lie like that. And yet it was true anyway for a moment. But that was in 2003. We've been bombing those people nonstop this whole time, telling them it's for their own good. And, you know, for them, for DC to pretend like that's the world that they're living in right now is completely ridiculous. When their whole strategy, of course, has to be recruiting the local Iraqi nationalist and tribalist Sunnis against, against the jihadists.
Yeah, and I think this is a really interesting. I think the Pentagon's kind of stuck in a 1980s model here of how it deals with publicity around war. It's as if Facebook, as if Twitter, as if social media has never been invented, and they just say, no matter how many times you ask them, no matter how much evidence you show them, they say we have no confirmation of civilian deaths. But meanwhile, you know, pictures are all over Twitter. You've got videos running on YouTube. People are seeing the pictures. Now, they may be right. It may not have been an Allied airstrike. Some of it might even be propaganda. But unless they actually engage with that stuff and say, actually, no, we didn't do that. Or, yes, we did do that. And we're going to deal with that. We're going to compensate that and so on. It's like they kind of pretend civilian casualties don't happen and they think it will all go away. And they did exactly the same in Libya, by the way. At the end of the Libya air war, the head of NATO, Rasmussen, stood up and said, hey, that was a great air war for us. We didn't kill a single civilian. And five independent studies came back and said, well, that's just not true. You killed anywhere between 50 and 80 civilians in those airstrikes. And in the end, NATO had to withdraw their claim that they hadn't killed a single civilian. So it's like they're stuck in this old model, and there seems to be a lack of understanding that, you know, there's a parallel war being fought on Twitter, on Facebook, on YouTube right now, and they're losing that war if they don't actually start to deal with these civilian deaths and say whether it was them or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the way my dad describes the coverage of Vietnam. Oh, we only lost five guys and we killed 1,000 of them is the official Pentagon statement. And then the next clip is the actual CBS reporter in the field going, oh man, it was a bloody massacre out here today. You know, and putting the lie to the official statement in real time. It's that same effect. Of course, they don't have CBS reporters who would be so bold these days, but we don't need them now as well.
But we don't need them now. You're absolutely right. And, you know, Iraqi friends of mine and, you know, I'm still able to talk to friends of mine in different parts of Iraq. And, you know, just for context, of course, you know, the number of civilians being killed, allegedly killed by Allied airstrikes, because we don't know the exact number, is really very small compared to the overall bloodbath going on out there. And you know from the work that anti-war is doing, I think the latest estimate just from August when the airstrikes began, almost 7,000 Iraqi civilians have died in that short period of time in the violence.
Which is as bad as the worst part of 2006 and 7.
Yeah, it is. We're into that civil war territory now. And we don't even know who's killed more than half of those people. We can't attribute who killed them. We just don't know.
Yep. Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, when you say it's less than 100 civilians were killed in the airstrikes in Libya, I mean, that sounds amazing. But then again, look at all the people who've died and all the strife caused by that war. So that all counts, too. But I'm sorry, the drum's beating. We got to go. Thank you so much for your time, Chris.
A real pleasure. Thanks,
Chris Scott. Woods, he's at foreignpolicy.com. See y'all tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Hey, Al Scott here for Whole Food Multicomplete at wholefoodcomplete.com. Whole Food Multicomplete is an entire supplement program in one bottle containing 100% RDA of vitamins and minerals, plus live probiotics, digestive enzymes, antioxidant herbs, energy nutrients, and more. It's made in America using real foods and live probiotics. No chemical synthetics. It's soy-free, gluten-free, and independently tested and verified. They're so sure you'll love it, they're taking 20% off your first order with coupon code Scott Horton. Satisfaction is guaranteed at wholefoodcomplete.com.